did enjoy the film, and that video. I mean, it's maybe boring to go into here, but like it was just one of those like comic situations where they had like the guy's first day tending bar at the AMC movie theater was like just then as we were showing up, and it took him like 25 minutes to make the piña colada for the guy in front of us, and I was just like tearing my hair out because we were just like it was already we like showed up at the time and like oh the previews, and it was just like one comical thing after the other. Like he ran out of wine just as he was pouring wine for Karina, for my partner, and then he like goes to get our beers and the kegs tapped, and I'm like, that's it, we're out of here. So it was like a lot of high stress to start that movie going experience, but it was I liked it. We're gonna get into it a little bit, I think, with our guests here, which maybe this is a good segue to introduce them. We have Jacob Bacharach, the novelist and Dune film disliker. He's gonna bring some spice here later on. And Claire Evans, Claire L. Evans, author of Broadband and technology writer and speculative fiction enthusiast, canonist, completist. And we're gonna be talking about doing the film, where it's at, how it was, how the weekend went, and then we're gonna get into the theme of the day, which is oil and ecology and climate change and how Dune talks about those things. Anyway, that's enough of me.
What about Tim Marchman? Hi, Tim Marchman.
I'm so glad to be here.
Nice.
Should we play the Dune music?
Let's play it.
Okay.
This is the Eno Dune Dune snippet.
It's the official Motherboard Does Dune theme music.
We don't half-ass anything, man.
Yeah. Based on an extensive search of like 5 minutes for Dune music.
Best synth Dune take. Yeah. So I think we can just get into it. Dune did pretty well at the box office. It got like 40 million intake. People were wondering if anyone would show up to the theaters, and they did show up, although that number wouldn't be that big compared to like pre-pandemic blockbuster numbers. So it's another data point in the streaming versus, theater going conversation, and it is in the world. People generally like it. It seems anyways, judging by Twitter feeds and Rotten Tomatoes, two notoriously infallible indicators of taste and quality. Has everyone seen the movie, first of all? Did everyone see Dune?
Yes.
Yes.
I have seen it.
Me too.
Right. Saw it. Smashed it.
Claire, what did your thoughts?
I liked it. I mean, it's hubris to even attempt a movie adaptation of this book. Like many great men have tried and failed, as we know. But honestly, I think it's as good of a Dune movie as we'll probably ever get. I found it be visually beautiful, relatively faithful to the book. Pretty tedious at times, which is also relatively faithful to the book. And there's so much information that needs to be conveyed in such a short amount of time that it's not easy. And like David Lynch, bless his heart, just like chose to do like a up top 15-minute explanation of the entire world, which is one way to do it. And I appreciate the economy, I guess, with which this film tackles some of these things. I mean, it skips a lot of key points, like the Butlerian Jihad, for example, which I'm sure we can talk about. But yeah, I liked it. I mean, I didn't love it. It didn't take me away, but I liked it.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that like that is like when people say that Dune is quote unquote unfilmable, like that's pretty much what they're talking about. There's a lot of exposition to get through. It's like a lot. It's more than just about anything else because there are, detailed religious orders and like feudal space houses that are all sort of in coexistence. And there's, mythologies of chosen one. And in the book, he uses this, like a past sort of telling in that it's like being like you get snippets of the history book where he just kind of like lays it out, so he gets to cheat. And yeah, I thought the same as you, Claire. I also wasn't honestly floored the first time I saw it. I thought it was pretty a pretty solid swing. And I like my, you know, my wife loves it. Like it, I was so surprised. And Jason, who hadn't read the book either, loved it. So a lot of people were worried, like, oh, are people who've never seen read the book gonna get it? And I think like they're maybe responding to it even more so than the diehards. Which I guess brings us to Jacob. You saw it. How did you see the movie? And what were your thoughts?
I saw the movie. I saw it in a home theater setup. So it was maybe not quite as loud as some people have said that it is, but it was still pretty fucking loud. And in large enough picture and high enough fidelity that I feel like I pretty much got the cinema going experience. I'm also in a very like low vaccine zone of rural Virginia at the moment, so I wasn't really ready to go into my local multiplex in the way that I might have if I had been at home in Pittsburgh. So anyway, with that long preamble, I don't know. I thought, in the words of cartoon critic Jay Sherman, it stinks. I am a huge Dunehead. I've probably read every one of the Frank Herbert books. I don't read that Brian Herbert trash, but the Frank Herbert books like at like 50 times each from the time that I was a teenager. So I love this world and this universe for all of its weird problems. And I there was almost nothing about the movie that I liked. I disliked almost every choice from the color palette to the sound mixing to the excisions of the weirdest but funnest dialogue in the book, to the moment at which it chose to end its telling of, people keep saying the first half, but actually maybe the first third of the story. Yeah. So I'm happy to go into detail about all of those things, but I'm a hater, an unrepentant hater of this Dune.
Let it flow through you. I love it.
Yeah.
Tim, maybe the noted also book lover, and you like the film, right, Tim?
Oh yeah, I think I liked it more than anyone here, with the possible exception Jason. I really dug it. I thought the ways it put a lot of stuff that was at the margins of the book, because it's so inward focused, you know, really paired well for me with the book. I regretted a lot of what was lost, and I don't think Jacob's wrong about much of any of it, but what was there, I think they did a ton with, and set it up for what will, after this box office response, hopefully be like a dozen sequels, all paced exactly like this, ready to be watched one after the other.
Yeah. Now, if we could return to you for one sec, Jacob, what's your favorite Dune book? Is it the original?
I like Dune and Dune Messiah probably equally. And Dune Messiah is the most interesting book of the series, the shortest and the most interesting one, because it's the one that completely fascinatingly makes good on sort of the subtle promise of the first book, which is to get you to believe that this guy is a giant hero and then show you that he's actually like the most terrible being who's ever lived in the history of the universe. If only George Lucas had understood what was going on in those two books, he might have actually been able to tell the story of Anakin Skywalker, I've always thought. Children of Dune is really talky and boring. Heretics, God Emperor is kind of talky and boring. Heretics and Chapter House then are a complete departure. He takes the universe in a totally different direction, which I actually love, even though they're by far the most troubled of the novels. So I guess that's my sort of ranking. The first two and then the last two, and then the middle ones at the bottom.
Interesting. Tim, what do you think? What are your faves?
Definitely the first one. And you know, I, as far as rereadings go, I've usually just stuck with the first four. Everything after that kind of comes into like weird late peak period of a band where they're just noodling for 17 minutes on side three of a double LP. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to get this deep. I admire the fortitude and resolve of the completionist. Yeah.
Claire, have you read Beyond?
Please don't put me on the spot and force me to reveal that I've only read the first one.
Oh, it's fair. I feel like it's fair. I said in the first stream that we did that when I was, like, the first time I was going through the books, I started reading Dune Messiah, and I was so mad. Like, I was exactly what Jacob was talking about. I was just like, I was like the 12-year-old, like, reading this for the first time, going like, no, I don't want to see this happen to my hero. If I stop reading, it's not real, and I close the book, like, and I gave it up for years and years. Yeah, I mean, I do think that the movie does lot like somewhat faithfully, and at least it sort of like conjures into being, I thought, at least this, the world that, like, the enormity and the strangeness of this world. Like, you may not agree with all the choices, but I did appreciate how, like, once it gets going, you do get a pretty good sense that there's this, like, generational hundreds of years sort of occupation. It's changed hands. It's being driven by this weird feudal space, emperor. And you sort of get the politics, you get the weirdness. They all have kind of, at least it's gestured at, their weird rituals and ceremony. And you get the Bene Gesserit a little bit. So I at least, I mean, maybe like the bar has been lowered after like decades of Marvel movies, but like, I get every time there's something like that that people respond to, that's like a little ember, like, flickers of hope that, like, some IP that hasn't, like, just been beaten to death, you know, on the big screen is getting a response. I think there are interesting things it does, right? Like, he's not Luke Skywalker. You're not rooting for him. Like, maybe he is priming the pump for Dune Messiah if he gets to make that. And it does, like, curdle in a big way.
You're not rooting for him? No, I'm definitely rooting for him thus far. Like, in the movie, at least. I don't think that Paul has done anything bad yet. Like, you know, he said...
I mean, he did kill that guy.
But the guy tried to kill him first.
Oh,
the guy was
okay?
Asking for it.
Yeah.
Right.
It was a fight to the death, you know?
Yeah, and Timothy Chalamet plays him well. He does kind of have, like, incel vibes to him, you know, like this entitlement and this broodingness. And he's like this good-looking movie star that people naturally want to root for. So I don't think really that Denis Villeneuve does much interesting beyond that, beyond just like plopping him there. And like, he says that, no, it's not a white savior narrative. I'm critiquing it. And it's kind of like, well, how, other than like having him scowl a lot. But I do think that at least it starts it off interesting. Do you agree with any of that, Jacob or Claire?
I mean, I will say that the screening I went to, I was sitting next to a pod of teenage girls who would scream and take photos of the screen whenever Timothée Chalamet was on screen. And then, like, leave and come back a bunch of times. So I think people are rooting for him. Maybe not for the same reasons.
I mean, yeah. I feel like, I don't know. Never send a twink to do a twunk's job, because Timothée was miscast in this role. I feel like a lot of people were miscast in their roles in this movie, actually. I think Villeneuve has actually never really been a great actor's director anyway. He's occasionally gotten good performances, like in some of his other shitty movies, like Sicario. Brolin is actually really good in Sicario because he understands how to play a villainous character with a smirk. But here, it's kind of like a little bit leaden. And he doesn't have the smirk, so his character, I think, doesn't work quite as well. But Timothy is like fine when he is in dialogue, in scenes with other people. Like, I thought that he was pretty good, like in the scene with the Reverend Mother in the beginning, in the Gamjavar scene. Even though I thought that scene was at the wrong place in the movie, but mm-hmm. I thought that he was good, and he played off of the. Off of the Reverend Mother quite well, but I think that when he like is individually like in frame or carrying a scene, especially in some of the like prophecy moments, I just don't leave it. Like, I'm just like, are you just, it's all reads like him just playing the same lovesick character that he played in Call Me By Your Name, rather than like the heir of a space empire. So
I get a little bit of like Harry Potter with his like, you know, his dream sequences and prophecies as well. Like, I felt like I was kind of watching Daniel Radcliffe do that. Although I don't know, I have no idea if Harry Potter kind of stole this idea from Dune, or if it's just such a normal trope, like the chosen one can see the future and change it, or see, you know, see other places in time. But that's kind of the lens through which I saw this movie, because I said Friday, like, I haven't read the book. And so I was watching and I was like, oh, this is like Tatooine and this is Luke Skywalker and he's kind of like Harry Potter and he's kind of like all these other things. And then it's like, oh yeah, well, they're all either stealing it from Dune or they're just like tropes that are so ingrained in science fiction at this point that it's not like, I watch it through the lens of I've seen this all before. But I thought it was, I still really liked it because I liked the world and I liked the sound and all that sort of thing. But I had no love for or knowledge of the source material. So it kind of, like, I was watching it through that lens, I guess.
Well, one big distinction between what's on the screen and all of what you just named is the villain, which I thought was by far the biggest weakness. I don't know if I'm rooting for Paul in the movie, because I don't even know what he's up against. You know, we get like three scenes of Stellan Skarsgård in some kind of like black soup. He's definitely portrayed to be somewhat villainous. He floats around with some sort of like repulsor rays beneath his nightgown. It's all pretty ridiculous. And Baron Harkonnen is one of my favorite villains in science fiction, because like the hammy, like, it's just so far beyond hammy. I think he has one of the great introductory lines in literature. He goes like, "Is it not a magnificent thing that I, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, do?" Well, he's plotting with all his minions, and we don't really get any of this joy of performance that I think you get in the book. And there's nothing really in its place. You just know Paul is basically against some like faceless space bad guys who want to make money. And they have a big army. They have like these orcs on another planet that they're buying in some vague way. And it's not even that the politics doesn't come through. It's that there's, you know, there's no Darth Vader. There's no Voldemort. And, you know, the source material absolutely has that. It goes in very weird directions with it. But it has, you know, a totally over-the-top villain that an actor could really sink his teeth into. You know, I thought that was definitely something that was missing.
Yeah. Hey. So you can't. I completely agree. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen is one of the great villainous creations. I mean, he's partly a product of Frank Herbert's own psychoses. Herbert was a famously homophobic man who disowned his own gay son and has really weird, horrible ideas about sex in general, which kind of comes through even in the first Dune. And so, of course, the Baron in the books, by contemporary standards, is highly problematic. He's like a lisping, queenie, gay pedophile. Those are all the ways that you know how bad he is, even more than like the violence and the actual terrible things that he does. But in the early 2000s, the Sci-Fi Channel did a really bad Dune miniseries, but they made one brilliant move, which was they cast Ian McNeice as the Baron, and he played him absolutely in just the like hammiest touring Broadway villain way possible, and it was completely marvelous, and he just loved being evil, and he actually ended many of his lines of dialogue in rhyming couplets for some reason. It was a strange decision the screenwriters made. So I missed that, both that type of like hammy portrayal of the Baron as just like a person who just loves being evil, and I missed that bit of levity in what is otherwise, I mean, the book too, completely a humorless text, right? No. So having this one kind of over the top kind of queeny, bitchy character as your main villain is a nice bit of tonal relief, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think that's one of the things, like, Lynch's film was all like was also problematic, right? But The Baron, at least, was like totally insane. And I mean, he probably amplified Herbert's sort of indicators. He's just this, like, yeah, pedophilic, just oozing, like, at the mouth over Fade Rautha, and he has like the heart plugs that he pulls out. So at least it was like something. I do think that I agree with you, Tim, that on second viewing that fared the worst. They introduced the Baron and he's literally just sitting there sort of like rubbing his face like Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. It's like, we get it. It's the Heart of Darkness. That's all. And that's all he could come up with. We'll just do that again. This is one way to segue, I guess, because they don't spend much time with him, but he's like literally bathing in oil. His home world is just industrial and black, and there are pools of oil and black like robot creatures or spiders that have been bred by, as we learned last stream, that was an actual person that's been sort of the product of weird torture eugenics. But it is reliance on signifiers is what I'm getting at here to show the evil. Like we're like, we just have like flashes in the scene. Like he's all about oil. Like all of the stuff, ecological stuff, like Dune was very, very sort of straightforwardly, you know, the spice was oil in the original series. Like it was, I mean, it's set in this sort of stand in for the Middle East for this commodity that's so important to, you know, Dune just blows all these things up in the world. It was to the global economy in Dune, the spice is necessary for like the galactic or universe's economy, making travel possible. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what is going on there. You know, from the source material, can you, Claire, talk a little bit about sort of what Frank Herbert was doing when he was thinking of the spice and making it sort of controlled by these warring houses and so central to the economy?
Yeah, well, you know what's funny is, like, on my initial reading of Dune years ago, I always thought that the fact that, like, the global commodity that was clearly a stand-in for oil, the fact that it was also a psychedelic drug was this kind of counterintuitive and interesting thing. Like, you know, like, just dose the Harkonnen, right? Like, at some point, they'll just see that everything is connected and, like, kind of vibe with the Fremen and let everything slide and be chill and peaceful. Like, it never really made sense to me. But then I think now, looking at it now and rereading now and watching the film and like thinking about what has happened with cannabis, for example, in the last 10 years, like, it totally makes sense, because even these substances, which are supposed to be like equalizing on some level and supposed to change our perspectives on the natural world and on one another and on our relationships with one another, even these substances can be like, you know, honed into these highly lucrative market commodities. In fact, somewhat tangential, but I had drinks the other day with a friend of mine who's like looking closely at the psilocybin space. He was telling me that like the price of sterilized grain is spiking because of the imminent legalization of psilocybin. So like, because mushrooms are cultivated on these substrates of sterilized grain. So basically like even psychedelics like can't save us from our like ourselves, like from our lecherous capitalistic extractive relationship with the world. I think the fact that it's oil and drugs is really interesting and touches like a couple of different places simultaneously.
Yeah. And we were talking a little while ago about how sort of Frank Herbert was, there's a couple layers to this. For anyone who hasn't seen it, the historian Daniel Immerwahr, I think is his name, has a great presentation on Dune and Empire, and kind of feel like does a pretty good job of showing what Frank Herbert was kind of up to in constructing a lot of this stuff. But with the ecology, there's a couple layers, and one of it was his sort of affinity, and maybe it was this sort of unhealthy fetishistic sort of relationship with his local indigenous tribe, but he was actually very, very close with them and kind of took a lot of the messages that they were you know, communicating to him and beaming them into Dune. And one of those that Immerwahr points out is the one where he, in fact, we're actually going to have him on the show, I think, on Thursday. So just noting that, but that one of the tribal leaders was talking about how this place in Washington where Herbert lived was getting sort of eroded and sort of degraded by the encroachment of civilization there. And he had like a direct quote where it was like, eventually this place will be nothing but a desert. And a lot of people think that that is one part of what, you know, was in the backstory of Dune. We learned that Arrakis was once, you know, vital. And Claire, you were telling me a story about sand dunes in Oregon or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is part of the lore of Dune, is that like Frank Herbert, when he was the investigative journalist, went to Florence, Oregon, which is, I mean, I'm from Oregon, it's a part of the state that is completely covered in sand dunes. It's very surreal. But he was writing about U.S. Department of Agriculture effort to essentially stabilize the expansion of those dunes using these European, these non-indigenous beach grasses, because the sand was like literally consuming this town, and it was spreading, and it was sort of getting beyond human control. Is almost like a living thing. And I think that that sense of the encroaching sands, the power of nature, the futile efforts to kind of like, you know, use non-indigenous plantings to stave off that encroachment, all of that thing sort of, I think goes into the lore of Dune and inspired Dune. I mean, allegedly he wrote an article that was never published called They Stop the Moving Sands, which I don't know if like that's available to find somewhere, if it's like in his paper somewhere, but that was ostensibly the foundation for the books. So yeah.
Jacob, and as a novelist, how do you read these themes, and like how did you originally or continue to read sort of the themes of ecology and like the centrality of oil to unlocking Dune?
Yeah. As it were? It's interesting because I think that the ecological component of the book is sometimes a little bit overlooked, because I think that what Herbert, I think that people read the allegory, the oil allegory, pretty neatly, and I think that maps like pretty well for most readers of the book. But some of the ecological things that it talks about, particularly, again, this, like, the movie doesn't really get to this because a lot of it really happens after Paul and Jessica fall in with the Fremen and begin to see in more detail than they only glimpsed in the first half of the book, like what the Fremen, like what they're actually doing in terms of planetary ecology, their sort of plan for effectively terraforming this planet, and so on and so forth. And it's interesting because within the context of science fiction, like when I first encountered this book, I was reading kind of all, like I was a young teenager reading all of the classics of like golden age sci-fi. So, you know, reading like Heinlein and reading Asimov and Friedrich Poole and all of those guys. And one of the things that you notice in a lot of those books is that like everybody zips from planet to planet, and the planets are all like Star Wars planets, right? Like one is a desert planet and one is a forest planet, but none of that is ever really explored. And I forget where I read this, but I read an article about Herbert Dune, and it said it was the first time in science fiction that you ever got a sense of how big a planet is. Mm. And I think that that's actually one of the triumphs of the book, is the way that it actually makes you feel the size and weight and complexity of this world, even though he goes out of his way to like make it, in effect, a single biome, right? Like the world is described as not actually that ecologically complex because it is a global desert. But even within that like sort of singular world spanning biome, he creates such interesting sort of diversity and subtlety and nuance in a way that makes you reflect on your own planet and your own environment in a way that I think few other books before the last maybe 20 or 30 years in science fiction ever did. For me, that was really affecting when I first read it as a kid, and continues to be, in some ways, I think, the most interesting part of what Herbert did in this project. It gets lost in the later books as they become more concerned with politics.
How did it affect you, if we can just, I might ask? Did it, in terms of raising an environmental awareness more generally, or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I my family's from Pittsburgh, but I grew up in the mountains, mostly in western Pennsylvania, like in kind of in the Appalachians and small towns. And so, you know, my friends and I spent a lot of time in the woods and in the mountains, just hiking around because there was nothing else to do in a small town. So I always kind of had, you know, felt an affinity for the natural world a little bit, but I was also, you know, a nerdy indoor kid who liked to read. And I think that Dune was one of those books that made me, awaken to sort of environmental awareness beyond simply like liking to go into the woods beyond my home, but actually thinking about the sort of interconnectedness of the natural world around us, and then of the impact of human activity on that world. Like to start thinking for the first time about like actually the strangeness of all of the human roads with giant hurtling machines that went through all the woods and the mountains, and like cars constantly running over deer, like thinking about what a strange thing that actually is. Whereas prior to that, you know, that was just like, well, there were roads in the woods. You didn't really think about that as an actual natural interaction between humans as a biological organism who are changing their environment and the environment that they're changing, you know?
Yeah. How really, intentional... Oh yeah, go ahead, Claire, please.
I totally agree. And I think like the greatest lesson of Dune, the book, and like hopefully the film, is that even the most seemingly hostile environments can be places where life flourishes, so long as we're able to negotiate our existence within those places, like through a relationships of mutual reciprocity, which, you know, of course, and I hope I'm not overstepping here, like is the indigenous view of reality. Like the Fremen are in this state of right relation with their planet. They don't take more than they need. They cultivate like these deep rooted plants. They move with the flow of nature rather than against it. And like, I think that like the extractive relationship that the Harkonnens have and House Atreides has too, by virtue of their participation in the entire colonial spice mining enterprise, is like, it's not just that it's unsustainable. It's like that it actually blinds them to the true nature of the planet that they're on, right? Like they literally can't even see the Fremen. They're undercounting the Fremen by the millions because they're like blind to the place, and they come to it like they're coming to war, and they think the planet is hostile, but it's them that's making the planet hostile, you know, like they have no humility. And like, meanwhile, if you know the rhythms of the planet, if you kind of walk lightly on the sand, if you know the ways of the desert, like it's life itself, it's life giving. You get to ride the sandworms, which I think is a really powerful lesson and something we could all really take with us. Another thing I want to say is I've been thinking about Dune just this morning in relationship to Ursula Le Guin's The Word for the World is Forest, or The Word for World is Forest, which is another book about like an extractive capitalistic project that comes up against these indigenous alien lifeways, and specifically lifeways that have profound relationship to dreaming. I think they're like two flip sides of the same coin in a way. I mean, I know it's like substitute the infinite sands for the infinite forests, and you know, obviously like Le Guin is 10 years later or something, and but I think it gets at a lot of the same questions, and maybe a little bit more of an more economically, and maybe with a little bit more sensitivity in some ways, and without all the weird eugenics. I've been trying to figure out if Frank Herbert and Ursula Le Guin knew each other. They must have. I mean, they both lived in Oregon, and I'm sure they went to the same conventions. But I would love to be a fly on the wall for those conversations if they had them.
I could
imagine those being a little bit awkward, given Frank's like raw prayer, like hatred of anything that reeks of gender non-essentialism.
Yeah.
It's funny because in the subsequent two books, so in Dune Messiah and then in Children of Dune, one of the actual kind of ways that you begin to see Paul and his heirs in a more negative light, and one of the kind of critical points of political contention, is the fact that the ecological transformation of Dune proceeds too quickly. Mm. So after Paul wins and basically becomes the emperor, and then eventually his sister and then his children kind of become his heirs after he...
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Seemingly dies. The Atreides devote a great deal of imperial power to, in effect, accelerating the terraforming of Dune, which the Fremen have, as you learn in the first book, have conceived of as not just like a multi-generational project, but as like a 100-generational project, yeah. You know, to slowly transform this planet. And even at one point, it's like it's implied that it's proceeding so quickly that the worms themselves are dying because the planet is becoming too wet too quickly, and thereby reducing the power of the Fremen because it reduces the availability of the spice. So it's very interesting to see how that happens in the subsequent books and how Herbert conceived of even changing of the timeline of the Fremen's own sort of indigenous project to transform the planet as being problematical, which always makes me think of some of the things that you read about the sort of the deliberate transformation of like the North American landscape by the indigenous peoples of North America, which was quite extensive, much more extensive than until a couple decades ago we were ever led to believe. The idea was like they just lived in this pristine forest and didn't do anything to it, which almost couldn't be farther from the truth.
Yeah.
But how their activities occurred along just an entirely different time frame from the capitalistic extraction style of environmental engineering that the Europeans brought with them, you know, field clearing and intensive agriculture and so forth. And I think Dune has a similar critique of that type of thinking and that shortened time frame of thinking about ecological decisions and impacts.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I feel like the play of time and the scale of Dune is a big part of what makes it as epic as it is. And the fact that, yeah, the Fremen are operating along this really massive time frame, but also the Bene Gesserit are thinking about things in terms of centuries and generations. I don't know what that says about, like, I don't know, the accelerative nature of technology and how quickly things develop. But everything is okay as long as you do it really slowly, maybe.
I'm curious to what you think about it, because I actually think to the new Dune's credit, some of this isn't, I mean, he doesn't follow through, and a lot of the commentary from folks who have been even Dune defenders is that he doesn't foreground, like given this opportunity, given that we're in the middle of a climate crisis right now, and that it is at the sort of at the foreground of basically everything we're doing, he doesn't take the opportunity, Villeneuve doesn't take the opportunity to kind of really make that a central point. But I do think that, you know, there are some of the things that come across, even if we see the Harkonnens as this intensely extractive and ruthless sort of the most destructive sort of embodiment of unfettered capitalism, then the Atreides come along and they're the heroes. And we do get the context, at least, that like, well, how are you different? What are you doing the same? And he kind of refuses to meaningfully change his policy. He's like, well, we got to go out in the desert. The emperor told us to be here. We got to go get the spice. We're going to do that. We won't go underground, though, which, you know, is just kind of a half measure that anyone would throw, and the policy continues apace. So you do get the sense that there are these long existing sort of rapacious mechanisms that are just plowing over this planet, and that people have, the Fremen have been, this movie opens with, you know, that monologue from Zendaya that's, you know, we've been oppressed for years. Who will our new oppressors be? So do you think the new Dune gets any credit for portraying sort of those forces of extraction and oppression in those blunt terms, as ham-fisted or as brief or as gestury as they are?
I think it's a weird thing, because one of the real strengths of the book is that it was very prescient. Like, it's easy to think of it, because it has these themes of ecology, as being tied up, you know, with the hippie movement. It was very popular among hippies. It was kind of like a standby, like the Whole Earth Catalog or something. And it also, you know, I think it's also associated in a lot of ways with the oil shock and with the initial embargo. It's kind of a book of that time. But it came out 10 years. He was writing it 10 years before that, at least. And like the initial publication of parts of Dune is 1965. So he's hit on these things that would be very central to the politics of the early 70s ahead of time, which gives it this kind of power. And a lot of readings of the book, I think, have been moored in those two things. The movie can't, I don't know that the movie really can work in the same way, because it's inherently a lot more crudely allegorical. You know, in the book, OPEC plays a huge role. It's Chome at a time when, you know, it probably wasn't on the lips of everyone in the suburbs, and the mid-60s are almost this innocent age where people are motoring across the fresh new highways and not even really thinking about how the gas gets there. They just, or what the price of that is, or what the cost of it is. And so there's this tension between what's going on in the book and what's happening in the real world and the context in which it's read that I really can't see working here. You know, Villeneuve is making it this, this vision of, what will happen to our planet if we continue down the path we're on. You know, I don't know if that even works. In some ways, I'm glad that he avoided that, because we're all going to read that into it. And on the other hand, part of me thinks, like, he just couldn't really be bothered and wanted to build big city size transports for armies.
Yeah. He also a criticism is that he kind of did remove the, another interesting thing about the book is that Chome that you mentioned, and that there's like a trade group, and that it kind of is explicitly made clear that like that these sort of the capitalist interests are sort of even above the emperor. Like he kind of has to listen to the guild and the demands of the, like there are many different layers of agency that the different, but even the feudal lords are kind of, succumbing to those dictates and they're kind of helpless before them. So he kind of gets that whole thing out of the picture. So there isn't really any corporate involvement. It's just kind of right, these warring houses. So I think that's another weakness in any potential metaphor making.
I also want to say, I think
I was just going to say, that is one thing. I'm not like one of these people who's like a Lynch Dune revisionist who's going to try to convince anyone that it's a good movie, because it's a bad movie, although an interesting bad movie. But one thing that he does, I think, very well, even though he departs from the book in the way that he does it, is depict the Spacing Guild and the Bene Gesserit and their relationship to the Emperor, for example, as being like much more complex, which is closer to the way that the book portrays it, like the emperor is himself being hemmed in by political obligations. We don't really meet the emperor in the Villeneuve Dune except via his couple of servants, and so as a consequence we don't really get to see that level of political complexity. So if a second one is made, it would be interesting to see if Villeneuve even tries to address that, or if he just kind of leaves it on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, I do really like that opening, the opening Lynch scene where it's like the weird guild, like it's just this like mutation of like feudo capitalism in space. It's just a cool scene. But all right, Claire, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, like, I mean, one thing that I think was a missed opportunity in terms of portraying how House Atreides is different from the Harkonnen, but also kind of the same in the sense that they're also just the new oppressors that are coming along, is the fact that House Atreides in the book are like really proud of their propaganda machine. Like they are really Duke Leto's like really concerned with disseminating like all this positive information about himself to the people of the planet and sort of like lettering the whole planet with propaganda. And
he's using social media influencers to do it very directly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally. That's very prescient as well. And I think that form of sort of, media-driven, information-driven soft power is a big part of the story, and I think is relevant to our particular moment, for sure.
I think just, like, watching this movie, and, I mean, it's been 4 days since I've seen it, and I need to watch it again, but I just felt like it was more a vibe, like a world-building piece, and I don't think that it had, like, that much to say. And I've started listening to the audiobook of Dune since then. I'm through four chapters, and it's obviously just like a much deeper world than the movie gets into, which I have a very low bar for movies. So it's like, yeah, I really like Dune. I really liked the environment and sort of the world building and the sound, And I thought that it had a better plot than Blade Runner 2049, which I really didn't like very much. Like, I thought that Blade Runner had the sound and the environment and world building, but I thought it was like extremely boring. Whereas this, I was like, oh, there's like some stuff happening. It was pretty slow, but I mean, I thought that it was just like there were interesting like plot points to follow, which is not the most advanced movie analysis of all time. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, in terms of what it had to say about climate change or like resource extraction or race, and like it just didn't seem to have much to say about anything other than sort of like acknowledging that they're there. It's like, yes, the Fremen are people of color. And sort of on Friday, Brian, you made the astute point that seemingly the only requirement for a Fremen was like, you are just like not white, like some sort of not white. It was just like a mix of people of color. And it's like, it's a dry planet and you don't really learn sort of like why it's dry, but you learn that like water is really important. And, you know, there's all this talk about why water is important, but we don't learn how it got that way. We don't really learn like who is doing the oppressing and why. It's more just like a vibe. That's kind of like what I took away from it. It's like, oh yeah, like it's a dystopian world and we're going to exist in this world. But I didn't think it had like that much to say in terms of like relating it back to the real world. And just even from the first four chapters of Dune that I've listened to so far, I'm like, oh, there's like a lot, like this is a lot deeper than the movie, which is understandable.
Yeah. And I do think to Tim's point, there all those things that like helped kind of, what we're doing in these conversations is kind of mapping out how it became, like Dune became, you know, kind of what a lot of these other things are taking their, like culture products are taking their DNA and their ingredients from. And the fact that that Herbert was able to kind of, or at least seemed like he was predicting the sort of the crisis in the Middle East and OPEC and that huge political fallout in the 70s, like I think did sort of further entrench like the centrality of Dune as like I think it also pairs with what Jacob was talking about earlier about what a world, you know, what you really feel like you're in this full world in a way I did too when I read it for the first time. It's probably what got me into science fiction. It like really powerfully kind of envelops you in this world, and this world is sort of based in the politics of sort of, you know, oil scarcity and sort of it does a lot of problematic things, but it did sort of pull out this really interesting and dynamic sort of slab that then like George Lucas and others could go like, oh, well, what if I made this a Western and it was only like an hour and a half long, and, you know, and then it was able to sort of export it. And I do think it's interesting seeing these conversations about, well, it seemed like Star Wars. It seemed like that. Like that was my thought in the movie theater. Like she's like, oh, do the voice. And I'm like, that just seems, people are just going to say that's a ripoff of the Force, even though, you know, it was kind of, it's become this sort of metatextual thing. Do we think that like this, you know, that this will show up more in the second movie, should it come, or are we just going to be vibing out? Is it kind of an empty cipher of what the original sort of text imparted unto us?
I kind of agree that it's all vibes, but maybe we just live in a vibe era. I don't know. I mean, I think the next movie will probably be all vibes plus like epic battles in the style of like Lord of the Rings or something. It's just going to be more of that with a bit more, you know, guys fighting other guys. I don't know. Yeah, I agree. My relationship to Blade Runner 2049, I actually really liked Blade Runner 2049. I saw it like three times in theaters, but only because it sort of reminded me of this ride they used to have at Disneyland called Soarin' California, where you're just basically like sitting on this little like chair that floats above these epic landscapes of California while like spritzy smells of tangerines and beach surfer blasted at you. And it's just like, you're literally just floating through this realm of vibes that are somewhat familiar. That's how I felt about Blade Runner 2049. It had all these sort of Soarin' shots. And I feel that way about Dune too. You're just kind of floating through it and immersed in it. But that's sort of like, I don't know. I don't know why, but that's like what people seem to want and seem to connect to in this day and age.
Should we compare it to Mad Max? Because it's just, it's so like, the world is so similar to Mad Max, and I felt like Mad Max Fury Road did have a lot to say, and maybe that's because it was so singularly focused on like water wars and sort of like resource extraction, whereas Dune is seemingly about like a lot of things at once. And I wonder if it's because Dune is trying, I mean, I don't know if you can fault the film for this. It's obviously based on a book that is about a lot of things, whereas Mad Max is kind of singularly about this, you know, post-water world, essentially. But it's like, Dune is trying to be about so many different things at once, whereas Mad Max Fury Road is about this singular focus. And I feel like Mad Max really did have a lot to say about, like, climate change and drought and what we're doing to planet Earth, whereas Dune is just like, here's a world and you're in it.
Well, Mad Max had, among other things, a really compelling portrayal of a villain, which, and a hammy fun villain, not to like harp too much on this point that I keep making, but an over the top hammy villain who, as terrifying as parts of the portrayal was, there were also some very funny things about that portrayal. And then that kind of cast the pursuit aspects of that movie. It made them even more propulsive than they already were. Also, that movie has much better cinematography, in my opinion, than this Dune. But I don't know. I felt like Mad Max Fury Road, which was a movie that I did like, also had a lot of vibes. I mean, I do think it had something to say about the destruction of the natural world and about the extractive economy. I also think, I guess maybe I'll praise Villeneuve here. I also think Mad Max, fetishized, you know, its cars and its sets in a way that maybe Villeneuve didn't. Like, they, as well designed as everything was in Mad Max, it wasn't necessarily as like, it didn't feel like quite as lived in, maybe, as the Villeneuve production design did. So I guess I'll praise him for that. Like, Villeneuve, there's a really great scene when they're first flying into the city, where you're getting the sort of helicopter shot of the palace. And if you pay close attention, you will notice that, like, there are piles of sand in all of the nooks and crannies.
Totally.
It's very thoughtful, and it's very subtly done. Like, nothing, the camera doesn't move or draw your attention to it. It's just there. And I really liked stuff like that. Whereas there was more of an element of like stagey theatricality to Mad Max. That's not necessarily a criticism, because I liked that element of Mad Max, but it is a difference, I think, between the two films.
Ah, we got something you liked. we dredged it up like the spice.
I'm just calling balls and strikes.
Yeah. I do think maybe there's like a slate pitch to be had in like the dull sort of portrayal of the villain, where like literally his last scene where he has like speaking lines, he's like, he just like emerges from the tub and he's like, good, release the spice, but keep the price low. We don't want to let it rise, or we don't want the price to fall. That's it. Like, it was just like this basic sort of like very like Econ 101 kind of like imparting of an order. Like, that was all. That's all he does, is basically like he's like a middle manager at a marketing firm or something. Just like, he just has like this like, oh, just do that, and he just like goes back beneath his oil. So maybe there's like, maybe there's a slate pitch in there where it's like the dullness of like
mundanity of evil.
Right. Just boring. A big, boring, fat guy.
There's like such an emphasis on like pomp and circumstance and ceremony and like the intensely vast hierarchy of regiments and the battalions and all these servants and the mentats, and at a certain point, like, you get to the middle where the leader is, and it's just like, it doesn't even have to be anything. It's like this empty core. It's really about like the actual bureaucracy that is so planetary scale, intergalactic scale, at the person in the middle. Like, do they even have to be charismatic? Do they even have to be present? I think they're just sort of like, it's because like the Duke Atreides is kind of like, I mean, he's supposed to be a good man, but he's just sort of like a rough template of like a good dude, you know, sort of moral, sort of loves his son, but it's a pretty like loosely sketched character in the film, at least, in the same way. They're both sides of the same coin. It's just blank good and evil, kind of.
Kind of the same in the book, actually, I think. I don't know.
And you only get the Villeneuve only permits a few little visual notes of it. And if you haven't read the book, you won't know why the fuck they're there, but he does show like the bull's head
yeah.
and the little sculpture of the Toreador in the book. Of and there's a throwaway line of dialogue between Paul and Leto about my grandfather died fighting bulls. In the book, a little bit more is made of that, and I think it's actually one of the funny things that punctures the Atreides mythology a little bit, which is like, yeah, okay, Leto Atreides he's kind of that, like you said, Claire, this sort of like generically like empty vessel good guy. Yeah, he's like upright and honest and upstanding and kind of has that like I chop down the cherry tree and I cannot tell a lie sort of thing. But the grandfather is basically portrayed as a sort of like rich playboy mm-hmm. who wasn't interested in ruling or governing. He was interested in bullfighting and blood sports and being just a rich aristocrat, you know, living on the prior planet of Caladan, which it's implied is a pretty cushy gig because it's basically like a water world. They don't have any resource issues there. So that's interesting as well, because the family background just keeps getting hinted at throughout the book. Is actually kind of one of like of sort of like aristocratic dissipation
mm-hmm.
Almost like that sort of almost like if you think about the sort of transition into modernity in Great Britain, for example, where you had these kind of like rusticated old nobles just sort of like living off the names of their houses and their rents, and then you had these kind of younger upstart merchant aristocratic families who became immeasurably more wealthy, sort of in the manner of the Harkonnen by harnessing the power, the new power of industry. And I think that there's some elements of that in Dune as well, where this kind of like almost chivalric code is sort of revealed to be inadequate to the modern world, but then the modern world's rapacity is also portrayed as being really terrible. And that's a sort of despairing vision, because what is the alternative? And then I guess, Claire, as you pointed out before, I mean, the alternative is some version of like the sort of like indigenous ecological balance, at least as Herbert imagined it, that's the sort of way out, which never really gets realized in any of the books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One question I had watching the film that I can't remember if the book answers, which is like, what happens to Caladan when they leave? Like, are there people left on that planet, or they just take everyone with them?
It's like a peaceful, flourishing utopian world. Maybe they just slid down into mutual aid and full-blown anarchism. You know, one thing I thought the movie actually did well, although they could have done a little more with it, was complicating Leto as this generic, this generic benevolent wise man, in that, like, the one element of his strategy seems to, which is never really spelled out, is desert power, right? Like, he is wiser than the rest of the imperial bureaucracy because he doesn't believe for a second that there are only a few 10,000 freemen. He thinks there are millions of them, and his big plan is to harvest them like a natural resource. He keeps talking about desert power, and throw them into a massive battle with these genetically engineered orcs from another planet, which on the one hand, this is portrayed as his goodness and wisdom that he realizes they're there. But he just doesn't seem to have really consulted them about this plan in any real detail. Which I thought was, you know, pretty clearly pointing out the human complicity as well as the, you know, consequences of their complicity in extractive campaigns. Oscar Isaac, who I generally think very highly of, I think could have played into that a little more. He definitely was going with like his two noble facial expressions throughout, and like
we
pretty
love
much any
those facial
situation.
Expressions.
Well, we do. He doesn't have to do any more than that.
There, I think if you talk about some of the things that get excised and unfortunately excised from the book, I mean, one of the book has all these really kind of talky set piece scenes. And one of the really good ones, it's in the movie, but it's portrayed totally differently in the movie, is when Paul attends his father's like council meeting. And in the book, Paul In the book, the meeting basically ends in dissipation, and Paul notices, like, he says in prior meetings that he'd been to, there was always an air of decision and finality when these council meetings wrapped up, but this meeting on Arrakis, after they've taken the planet, ends in kind of dissipation and confusion. And Paul, of course, it's not put this way in the book, but Paul basically begins at that point to think, is my dad a huge dumbass who is in fact totally inadequate to the task set before him? Are we in fact doomed? Do we in fact lack the sort of like the rigor to respond to the challenges that are marshaled before us? And that fear and that sense that like his dad, like a nice guy, but maybe just not smart enough and subtle enough and tough enough, gnaws at him, and then comes back in an interesting way as his father becomes a sort of part of the religious artifice that he and his mother begin building around themselves once they fall in with the Fremen.
Right after his dad gets Sean Beaned there. Yeah, it is. Totally. And I think that is one of the strengths as a movie. Like, if I were making this movie, and if I was only going to make the first third of the movie, like, I mean, I did feel like all the dialogue was like sandwiched between, like, almost like they were almost like the dialogue was like interstitials between, like of a spoken word interstitial between like a 90s music video or something. Like, a huge wall of sound dissipates, and then people are able to say their one line, and then another wall of sound takes off, you know? And I would have loved to, like, Dune has all those great scenes that you just were talking about, Jacob, and the dinner table scene where there's like all these sort of political machinations going on. And then, and I, pulling some of those out instead of like jumping awkwardly to the desert may have served the movie a little bit more. Cause I still kind of feel like a lot of ways this movie was kind of like Lynch's approach without the front heavy sort of exposition. He's hitting all the major plot points and kind of moving on and not letting like the characters really marinate or talk to each other all that much. And I think, as you commented, they're like spending more of their time sort of gazing wistfully at the desert or Caladan that they're going to leave than they are actually sort of, you know, behaving like people on this place that they found themselves in.
Yeah, everyone's like a way less interesting, way less fun version of themselves. I mean, we've talked about that in the context of the Duke Harkonnen, but also like Gurney Halleck, you know, who in the book is like this like troubadour bard figure that is like delighting the troops with songs on its balisette. I think that probably would have come off corny and weird in this movie, but I do miss that sense of like conviviality and comradeship that they have with one another. It like sort of explains why they are throwing themselves into the situation, you know, hand in hand. I think the only moment you really get with that is like when Paul goes like running and hugging Duncan Idaho, who inexplicably they're really close, but you know, you don't get that familial love even within the members of the family in the film.
And Duncan Idaho also, you miss out on, I mean, he's such a weird character because Herbert, you know, brought him back in all the subsequent books and made him so central to his universe. But he actually plays a relatively like minor role as a family retainer in the original Dune. But the one thing that you do get is that he absolutely wants to fucking bang Lady Jessica. But then he gets...
Well, she's not married.
He's not married, that's right. And he gets, and then he's like, and because there's, in the book, there's suspicion, they know, they kind of know there's a traitor, and suspicion falls on her, because she's Bene Gesserit, for a variety of other reasons, and they sort of like set Duncan to keep watch on her, and he does, but he really wants to fuck her, and he's also a drunk, so he gets really drunk and sort of reveals the fact that he's been spying on her, which sets in motion a bunch of realizations for her as well, and has some plot impacts down the way. And it was like, I wish Jason Momoa is just like a sexy dude. Like, I kind of wish that they had allowed a little bit more of that interplay instead of just having him be kind of like daddy to little Timotei. I don't know. Rebecca Ferguson is much more formidable and up his alley than Timotei is, I'm sorry to say.
I think this is the part where I jump in and am a buzzkill because I have to go to a meeting in a few minutes. So should we wrap this up since I'm pushing it to the internet when I have to go, unfortunately, this dream has to end. Any more thoughts on ecology or resources or anything else before we say goodbye until tomorrow?
I mean, thousands, but none. Fine.
We have only four more hours of Dune chat, so hopefully we can touch on some of these things. I do think that that Jacob, the points you're bringing up about sort of the geopolitics of the whole situation are something that we're gonna follow on Thursday with Kelsey Atherton and Matt Galt and Edward and someone else, perhaps, Brian?
Yeah, Daniel Immerwahr, a historian who thinks a lot about Dune.
Yeah. What do we have up tomorrow?
Tomorrow we have, we're going to be talking about the mysticism and sort of the psychedelic culture and drug culture of Dune. And we will be joined by David Kleon, who is another noted Dune fanatic, and Harris Durrani to talk about how a lot of that stuff was appropriated from Muslim culture.
We'll also be having Shayla Love on, who covers psychedelics in the mind for Motherboard, and yes, we'll have some pretty interesting things to say about it. I think she liked the movie.
Interesting.
And she's been the top reporter on sort of the commercialization of psychedelics, which Claire was talking about earlier. So mm-hmm. I think can add a lot more context there.
Yeah, as you were saying, Claire, the dual purpose of the spice is just so inherently fascinating. It's not a choice like a lot of other people have made. It's one of those things people have ripped off so much stuff from Dune. And this is one they seem to have not done, among many other things. It's just technically it's a fascinating way to get into different elements of the plot and connect them to one another.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big missing context of this film is the fact that they don't talk about the Beleriand Jihad. They don't talk about the fact that, like, artificial intelligence is banned for centuries and, you know, like, technology is all psychic and mental. So the fact that there would be a drug that is also essentially, like, a fossil fuel that powers space travel, those are one and the same because all technology is technology of the mind. That's, like, I think, even just hinting on that would have made the whole sort of psychic entheogenic pageant of it all much more comprehensible. So I'm excited to hear you guys talk about that.
That's a great point. Well, yeah, thanks so much for joining us, both of you. This was really fun.
Yes, thank you indeed.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm gonna play us out with our theme music. There we go. I feel like I want something more like pounding here, but it's good.
Marshall drums, yeah, of some sort.
Could probably find.
Just use the Mandalorian theme.
Yeah, we could do that. Well, thank you, Claire and Jacob and Tim and Brian. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi,
thanks,
y'all.
Everyone on Twitch.
Thanks.
Bye.
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 Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.